So I seem to have lost the ability to count to 10.
Right. Okay. What's happened then?
So, we got this Enneagram day this Saturday, and there's very strict kind of 10 spaces, and that includes Ali and me, so really 8. Because my dining room is small, as you know, and I appear to have 11 people coming. So I did that wrong.
11 people coming in addition to Ali or including Ali?
No, including Ali. So, no, but what
Right,
I've had
okay.
to do is I've gone on Facebook Marketplace, of course, and I've had to get a stool
Okay.
because we've run out of furniture, we've run out of chairs.
So you've had to buy furniture in order to run this day.
So, yeah, no, I bought a little stool.
Well, I think, listeners, there you see exactly the problems we have in planning anything to do with this podcast, summed up in that little anecdote.
Thank you.
Welcome, everybody, to episode. Well, do you want to count this one? It's up to you, really. I'm going to go with 315, but you might have 316.
Well,
I don't
look,
know.
I'll tell you something, my friend. I went to this I went to this production, this magic show called The Dreamer, a chap called James
Oh, okay.
Whelan. Yeah, last Thursday. And the first part of the show was magic, all very fun, but I've seen magic. Not that I know how it's done, but I've seen it before. But what I've never witnessed is someone doing hypnotism. And he did do this thing on loads of he called about 20 people up on stage, not me, I hasten to add. People he'd already determined are quite susceptible because he got everyone to do a few exercises. And he just hypnotized a lot of them. And then he went round them one at a time. So none of them could move. Their feet were like they were in cement. And then he made them sort of forget a number, like 6. And so they'd count their fingers and they'd go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. And they couldn't remember their names. It's very
Right.
weird. It's very strange to behold and witness. I mean, it was crazy, some of the stuff that was going on. How susceptible we are.
Do you think some of that rubbed off then? Do you think you've got some residual hypnosis?
I think I may have got when it comes to counting places in my dining room.
You've inhaled secondary hypnosis,
I
basically, and you've
think
now forgotten the number 10.
I think so. I just skipped straight to 11.
Yeah, I never understand how that works. I
No,
find it really odd, and yeah, I don't know. I don't know whether it's all a con or what. I don't know,
yeah.
really.
No,
I
it's
don't
not. I mean, that is a very genuine thing that was happening there.
Yeah.
These were just people, we were sat next to. Yeah. Very odd.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, anyway, so church notices. Firstly, the Enneagram day is oversubscribed,
Yeah.
and some poor bounder will get to sit on a stool.
Now, well, I'm going to sit on the stool.
Oh, are you? Okay. Is it a high stool? Will you tower over
Actually, I
everyone?
will tower over everyone. So I feel like it's an important power dynamic there.
Excellent,
I
excellent.
shall be
That's
high
good.
and exalted.
Indeed, you will. Do we have any other church notices?
Well, only that people are saying we're still awaiting details of the home group, Nick, which I've announced. So it's going to happen.
Well, for those of you awaiting details of the home group, I refer you to the previous few minutes of this podcast and the supreme planning
Very
genius that
unfair.
is Joe Davis.
It's coming. I think, shall we say, spring slash summer 2025.
I think it's coming in the same sense as Jesus is coming. I
Exactly.
think the
Exactly.
home group will arrive like a thief in the night. It'll
I
suddenly be there.
know. Jesus is probably slightly better organized. He does have a lot more resources, to be fair.
He's got all those angels for one thing, with a lot of clipboards.
I bet he delegates all that sort of admin
Yeah,
stuff
yeah.
out. Yeah, it's not
Yeah.
fair.
No, not really. Anyway, apart from the residual hypnosis, how are you?
I was all right. I mean, this is sadly, in some ways, my busy time of year. So I'm very busy with work. Sunday, of course, is a big day. Saturday's a big day, but Sunday's a big day. It's the first of our undefined. The thing which isn't a church that meets on a Sunday and encourages people to follow Jesus, that thing.
Okay, that thing.
So yeah, we'll talk about that sometime, but first let's see what it's like. I'm trying to play it down because it is just a conversation amongst friends, right. And we're inviting new people in to become our friends, really. So that's all it is. We'll have a croissant and a coffee and a conversation and some sort of prayer slash reflection slash meditation. Maybe we'll sing a chorus. Who knows?
I've got a suggestion for you when it comes to that one, but
and I'm looking forward to hearing it. Anyway, I'm fine. How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. It was our 40th wedding anniversary
what?
This week.
I didn't know that.
Not ours. Not you and me.
No. But we've been going much longer.
We've been effectively sort of husband and wife since about 1990, I think.
Congratulations.
Claire and I, 40 years.
Yeah.
40 years.
That's going some. It's getting the hang of it.
I know. You'd think I'd be good at it by now. It's good. I've just realised we're past January the 15th, so that means we're over halfway through winter.
Oh.
That's a little thing, isn't
that's
it?
That's good news. Yeah, it's
equinox wise, we're already on that. But in terms of the winter months, I quite like that feeling.
Mm.
Rather late, I've caught up with this television program, Apple TV program called Severance. Do you know it?
Oh yes, I love Severance.
Very good. Okay. I didn't realize it had been out that long, but Martha and I binge watched that a bit last night. That's fascinating.
It's good, isn't
it? That is very, very good.
May I just gently but firmly rebuke you over something? Have you finished Ted Lasso?
Season one, yes.
No, look, there are three seasons, the most magnificent of which is season three. And you are fiddle faffing around with Severance.
Yeah, but this is the thing, Joe. We start these series and we look at them and enjoy them for about two or three episodes. And you look at them and there's 10 in the season.
No.
And you know that they're planning another season and therefore there'll be another
there
10.
There are no more Ted Lassos. There are no more.
No, I know, but there's still four seasons of them, aren't there?
No, there's three. There's three seasons. It comes to an end. It gets better and better. It is joyful. It is life enhancing. You should watch
it. Yes, well, I will. We will watch it. But, you know, we don't like to rush into these things.
Quite so.
And then, look, I don't want to whinge and moan.
No, that's not like you at all.
No, about worship songs.
Oh, no. You found a new one, haven't you?
So, this one, I was in an event where they were singing it. And I don't want to malign anyone who's chosen it. Fine, you know, if that's what floats your boat. But it was very strange. And it's called Is He Worthy?
Oh, it's a question.
Chris Tomlin. Yes. And it's all question and answer. That's the thing. So the lyrics, the lyrics go.
I'm laughing already and I don't even know it.
The lyrics start, do you feel the world is broken? And then an undefined group of people reply, we do.
Okay. Yeah. Nice.
Do you feel the shadows deepen? We do.
Okay.
And I just got to those two questions and I was thinking, that's too easy an answer. I can't be singing a response like that. If you say, do you feel the world is broken? I would want to sing depends or might be, or, you know,
you're a disruptor.
Do you feel the shadows deepen? Sometimes. And then it goes on, but do you know that all the dark won't stop the light from getting through? We do. You see, so now we're talking. There's right answers here.
Okay. Yeah.
First two goes, is all creation groaning? It is the response.
All right.
And is a new creation coming?
It is. Yeah.
But that time I was singing, is it?
Yeah, of course you
were. Is it good that we remind ourselves of this? We all sing, it is. You know, it's
odd, isn't it?
It is strange. And I think what also made it worse is it didn't follow in the, I think, worthy tradition of 1970s worship songs, in which the women always sang the submissive reply.
You would have got away with it. Yes, exactly.
You know, if all the men sang the first question and then the women sang it is or might be or depends or could be or who knows. Actually, that's what I should have sung throughout. I should have just sung who knows as an answer.
Yeah.
But I could see what he was doing. He's trying to inject a little bit of innovation in. That's good. Yeah. I, all right. all right, I can go with that. I think it's a bit clumsy, but I can go with it. But then you get to the chorus, right?
Yeah.
Is anyone worthy? Mm. Is anyone whole? Is anyone able to break the seal and open the scroll?
Ah.
I mean, I don't know what the seal's done to annoy people, but he is going to get... He is going to get shattered, that seal.
It's starting to sound like Taskmaster, but yeah, go on.
And then the answer, of course, is this, the follow-through lines. The Lion of Judah who conquered the grave, he is David's root and the Lamb who died to ransom the slave.
Nice. It's good to see they're avoiding the jargon there.
Yeah. I mean, it's like Lego, isn't it? It's Lego worship, basically. You get these building blocks of just chunks of Bible
chunks
and you put them
cliches
together in any order. You just pile them up, make a great big pile. And then we all sing it and we have to go, he is, at the end of it, you know. And instead of you, what the natural response is, you what?
Listen, I'm sure it was very prayerfully done. And I do want to say for the listeners, we rant about these things so you don't have to. I mean, this is a public service Nick's doing here.
I don't know. By the second chorus, I decided it was time for a toilet break, and I just went, you know. I mean, not literally.
Did you go to the toilet, or did you just go? Yeah. Is anyone's bladder full?
It is. So, there we go. Strange worship song of the week. There it is.
Thank you for taking up so many vital minutes of this packed podcast.
I think this is what people don't pay their money for.
This is exactly
the content they require. Yes. Anyway, let's get on because we've got some feedback, which is lovely.
We have, and thank you everyone who's written in. First, let's start with the really important one first from Matty. Right. He says, hey, Joe, apologies if this is the most common bit of feedback this week. In fact, it wasn't, Matthew. But just in case the rest of the 17 aren't sci-fi nerds, I thought I'd do my best to answer Nick's question about why people in Dune use swords when they've got all those gun options. He says, firstly, he can be forgiven for not understanding, as it's only apparent if you read the books, which I did years ago. The book suggests that anyone who was anyone had a personal energy shield device attached to their belt, which was active at all times. Anything moving fast enough to be a threat, like a bullet, was stopped by it, rendering such weapons useless in combat. As only slower-moving things like knives and swords did the job, that was everyone's go-to weapon. I think there was possibly one very brief moment in the first film where Paul was being trained in combat and they discussed you had to slow down your strike with the knife so it would go through the shield. As ever, loving the podcast, keep up the good work from Matthew, not Matt. So there you go. That's why they use swords in Dune.
Yeah, but there are lots of other points in the films where soldiers, who you would have thought would have had these energy shields, are shot with lasers.
Okay. Yes.
So I don't think it entirely explains it. And also, I was talking more generally, actually, about, you know, a lot of sci-fi films use swords, like Star Wars.
Lightsabers, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We know they've got guns. Han Solo has a gun. Use a gun.
Okay. Yeah. Fair
Shoot
point.
People. And don't wait till they see you so they can deflect it. Shoot them in the back. That's how it works.
You ought to be the new American, you know, minister for war or something.
No, I realised that I would make very boring films in which, no supervillain would ever explain their plot. They would just sort of have James Bond killed from a distance. There's a great big bomb thrown on him or something. Yeah. And it would be over in about 10 minutes. Anyway, thank you, Matthew.
Good, good. Sharon says, hi, Joe, Nick. Big fan of the podcast here. You guys are awesome. Let me know when you take over the Isle of Wight. I'll come and set up refugee commune for us Americans. Thanks for that. You'll have so much room in Greenland, though. You won't need the Isle of Wight.
No, you won't need the Isle of Wight. Yeah, exactly. No, you've got Greenland, you'll have Panama, you'll have
lots of places. She says, something that's helped me with the gnarly bits in the Bible has come out of my journey over the past year or so, in which I've been gifted with a deeper understanding and experience of God's love and intimacy. I've had these barely describable moments of almost unbearable joy in knowing the love of God. And now I cannot imagine anything worse than facing God, as we all must, finally, fully knowing his pure, merciful and loving nature, and knowing that I'd spent my life rejecting him. He says, what worse punishment could there be than that moment? As you said, a consequence of how life was lived, a consequence unimaginably soul-crushing. I imagine the biblical writers trying to find words to describe that moment, that feeling, and the best they could do is burning fire, gnashing teeth, etc., etc. And then, of course, after the worst possible moment, no one will be able to resist the forgiveness and mercy offered. What a gift to have been given the grace to know God now, to not fear that gaze, but to long for it. This has also helped me, especially as an American in 2024, with my goal to do better at loving others. And then she puts in brackets, all of them, ugh. Instead of picturing them burning in eternal damnation, gratifying, of course, I imagine them at that moment face to face with love. The way the artifice, arrogance, confidence, anger all drop from their face. I imagine God's sorrow now as they ignore and reject his grace. I tried to read the angry parts of the Bible, hearing a tone more of sorrow than fury, and that helps. Anyway, I could be massively off base, but it feels right to me and helps a bit. Cheese, Sharon.
Oh, cheese to you.
Cheese
well,
to you, Sharon.
Lovely. Yeah, I think that's helpful. Yeah. I like that. I certainly like the idea of reading the Bible with hearing a tone of sorrow more than fury. I think that's absolutely. I always think back to the Genesis story, you know, and God walking in the garden and the sense of sort of sadness when he says, where are you?
Yeah,
you know, whatever you think about the story, I don't think God is furious, not shouting. He's sad at that point. And I think I think that's really helpful. George MacDonald talked about love being linked with judgment in the sense that he said nothing is inexorable but love. And love he saw as would actively burn away you know the bad stuff. That was what it was all about. It was about loving you back into community.
Love that.
I did think it reminded me of a cartoon I did at the beginning of A Nearly Infallible History of Christianity, where I had an icon of Jesus And he was saying, he was just saying, I'm not angry, I'm just very disappointed.
Yeah, that's worse, isn't it? Yeah,
which I think is probably what he feels about Christian history. But you know, there we go. Thank you for that.
Yeah,
Sharon, I thought it was really helpful.
Okay, and on a similar note, Andrew says, DJ, I'm just listening to Whack-A-Mole on the train and wanted to chip in something I heard recently, which was that word justice in the Old Testament. It at least means setting things right. I think culturally we tend to hear justice as something involving punitive consequences, often unrelated to actions. But what if eternal ruin means that people who have taken too much will be put back in their place? He says, like Jeff Bezos losing all his money and having to live like a normal person. Judgment Day is then the reverse for the very poor, for whom things being set right is really good news. Also, I've been trying to think more about the New Testament being written primarily to people at the time. I wonder, therefore, if Paul is writing in a flowery way about what the Romans will do to Jerusalem a few years later. The temple was destroyed, and I'll bet there was a fair bit of teeth gnashing as a result. I'm not sure about this, but I do think it's a mistake to rush into assuming things predicted in the Bible have not happened yet. He said both these points might be rubbish, in which case ignore them, but thanks for continuing to encourage, entertain and stimulate. That's from Andy. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I wrote a book on Revelation. Keep mentioning books. I don't. But the reason I did that is because I think a huge amount of the book of Revelation is about events that have already occurred.
Yeah.
And which were occurring to the all around the people to whom it was written.
Yeah, well, say a bit more about that, because I'm not sure everyone will be on board with that. So help us understand it.
Well, largely this the events of the temple and the first Jewish revolt in 67 to 70 AD, when the temple was destroyed.
Yeah.
Mostly, I think what Jesus talks about in terms of the eschatological stuff is about that. It's about the way that the culture and the society, in a sense, were going, and that it was almost inevitable there was going to be disaster. And I think certainly in Revelation, there's a huge amount about that is about the church escaping. So historically, traditionally, the church from Jerusalem escaped to a place called Pella, which is a bit north, you know, and reestablished itself. But so I do think that there's a lot about the events. And I mean, a lot of Revelation is political. It's about how you relate to empire, the Roman Empire, and it and its imagery is a direct sort of rebuke to the imagery of empire. And so, yeah, we miss that. Because we're not aware of that, so we sort of assume that, that most of it hasn't happened. I think Andy's right. I think a lot of the eschatological stuff in the New Testament is effectively about that event.
So we always think it's about personal salvation. We think the whole Bible is about personal salvation. Yes. But actually a fair reading of it tells you it's about history and about people and nations and events that are happening.
I came to write the book of Revelation because I saw a coin, a Roman coin, and on the back of it, it had a little child, and he was holding the world in his hand, and above him were seven stars. He was sort of holding seven stars. Mm. And that immediately made me think of Revelation, because it opens with Jesus, I'm the one who holds seven stars, and see, I hold seven stars in my hand, and this kind of stuff. Mm. And that Roman coin depicted the... we don't know his name, the son of the Emperor Domitian.
Wow.
And so what that said to me straight away is the image of Jesus there is in direct opposition to a Roman piece of propaganda.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. And therefore, there's so much in Revelation that is actually politically based.
Yeah.
And about what is going on. And yet we view it almost entirely as a timetable for the end times.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like Jesus is Lord, we see as a very personal statement about salvation and everything, but actually it was a political statement. It was Caesar, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's cutting right through there. The other thing I'd like to say about Andy's point about justice, which I think is really, really important and very well made. Mm. So the for example, the Greek word dikaiosune, which is translated for sort of righteousness, can be translated as justice. But it sort of means God steps in to put things right.
Mm.
The setting things right is exactly what it is. Mm. And so he's exactly right. Judgment is not necessarily about punishment, but about setting things right.
Mm.
And some measure of response or remorse or something or reparation might be part of that. And I think that, again, that is something we've absolutely forgotten in our culture. I used to work a lot with charities that are involved with prison reform and sentencing reform.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And a lot of that was about restorative justice. And I remember a judge saying to me once, I wasn't up in front of him, I was just in a conversation at an
for
event.
For once.
And, yeah, for once. And he said, you know, we forget that all justice is supposed to be restorative.
Yeah.
Because people will come out. So it's supposed to actually...
Mm.
bring you back into society, whereas we see it as retribution, we see it as punishment the whole time.
Yeah.
So I think there is a biblical understanding of justice as restoration of the right order.
Love it.
And how things should be. Yeah, great.
Okay, that's all very good. Okay, so moving on. Mark says, hello Joe and Nick, I enjoyed listening to episodes 313 and 314 while unblocking a drain, which seemed to isn't that wonderful? How many times have I sat in a sermon and thought, oh, I wish I was unblocking a drain right now?
Well, that worship song unblocked a drain of sorts, it's I suppose.
It's the advantage of podcasts, isn't it? The world has changed to a better place. Anyway, he says, it seemed appropriate. I wanted to thank you for the really interesting discussion about what faith and belief look like as you grow as a Christian. It coincided with a house group discussion on how those who are led by the Spirit are children of God. And this really chimed with me, having listened to your thoughts. I was struck by the privilege of intimacy with God. My daughter has recently become engaged, and it's been a real joy to welcome our prospective son-in-law into our family, to have someone who in time will hopefully call us mum and dad. This seems like a nice image of our relationship with God. We are adopted children, able to use close family names. He said, it also reminded me of something which is so easy for me to forget, that as a member of God's family, I have the ultimate protection, safety and security. Nothing else matters and nothing can take the place of that. As someone who has been through what have felt like hurtful experiences in recent years, he says, I've grown to realise that I need to, in fact, I am able to, put that in its proper place. In contrast to the freedom, joy, peace and love we have, other things fade away. I can ruthlessly put to death the misdeeds of the body, a quote, and stop entertaining the anger or hurt or the past, and stop spending time with the gods who failed, to give another fully warranted shout out to Nick's excellent Dark Knight of the Shed. He says, instead, I'm able to spend more time trying to love those around me, which is what I can do as one of God's beloved children. And that's from Mark. Thank you, Mark.
Yes, again, an image that is really occurs a lot in the New Testament. The image of new family and being adopted. Paul talks a lot about adoption, you never really hear much about that. We don't sing songs about that. We sing a lot of songs about justification and all that kind of stuff. Mm. But actually, adoption is also a key theme of his. He talks about spirit of adoption in Romans 8. Mm. You know, and to that meant you had an entirely new family. You had an entirely new clan, tribe, whatever you want to call it. A new set of relationships that you were brought into. And you had all the benefits and all the privileges of that family. It was Romans often adopted children for individuals from other families to secure their succession because they thought they were good. Like Julius Caesar, I think, was adopted into the Julian family. But anyway, So they kind of had this idea that you could become part of another family in order to secure a kind of succession. And I think Paul talks a lot about that kind of thing.
And that line about that Dallas used to say about, I'm perfectly safe in the kingdom of God. And you initially think, what? No, I'm not safe. Do you realise what's happening to me? But he was talking at that sort of meta level that actually you are who you are. You're an unceasing spiritual being and you're safe in God. Nothing can touch that, which is a good thing to be mindful of. Well, on a related theme, Claire wrote in with this, and it's really nice. She said, I've been thinking about my new theme as it's somewhat summed up in this pic I saw on the socials. I'm keen to try and leave situations I'm involved in no worse than when I encountered them, and as far as I'm able, to leave them better. She said, if I'm brutally truthful with myself, I can add to conversations stuff that might not be entirely edifying and uplifting, and I'm keen to make a change from this. I think the what would Jesus do mantra a little glib, but actually if Jesus were physically present in these conversations, I might hold back saying a few of these bits. Anyway, perhaps that's what loving and serving the Lord will look like for me this year. And she sent this picture, and I'm going to read it to you because obviously I can't show it to you. And it says this: life is short, and we do not have much time to gladden the hearts of those who travel with us. So be swift to love, make haste to be kind, and go in peace to love and serve the Lord.
Mm.
I really like that. It's just good just to come back to basics every now and then. And I love this. Surely as followers of Christ, it is our mission to plot goodness for those around us. And I think that little phrase there sort of sets the intention just right. So what a great theme for the year. We haven't done our themes, Claire, because as we know, the new year is not until March the 25th. And actually, Philip wrote in with a piece about the Wyville Monument. I'm not sure what the Wyville Monument is. You probably are, but it clearly states that new year in this country is on the 25th of March. And that was quoted from a piece in 1617. So I don't know if that's when it changed or whether it changed earlier than that. Do you know?
Yes, I do know, actually. I don't know what the Wyville Monument is. I assume it's a monument to somebody called Wyville.
Yeah,
I imagine.
Frank Wyville, I would imagine.
Oh, hang on, I've looked it up. Hang on, here we go. Suddenly come through. I was just typing while I was
well, it's good to know you weren't paying attention as normal.
No, it's a monument in a church in Masham or near Masham. Yeah. Masham's great. Masham's in Yorkshire. Masham's the home of the Black Sheep Brewery.
Okay.
That's really good. Anyway, yes, 25th of March was still sort of legal administrative new year in the 17th century. It changed in 1752, became 1st of March, 1st of January became the official new year. But 25th of March was the sort of English new year for all kind of administrative stuff from about the 12th century, I think about 1150, something about that.
Okay, so this came in from Kathy. She thanks for the podcast. Just read The Dance of the Dissident Daughter by Sue Monk-Kidd. This came with a strong recommendation from my wife, Rachel, it turns out. And she says, this book has blown my mind. She said, I've not suffered a fraction of the downside of patriarchy that she did. After all, we are 30 years down the road from her book, but I've certainly been very negatively affected by it, and it was no surprise a very big part of my current journey. However, she says, this book has made me feel very uncomfortable. She said, it turns out there's a huge difference between revisiting the difficult Bible texts concerning women in order to find a way to make you now know to be the truth, still work with your love of the Bible and what Sue Monk Kidd is uncovering. She is on a completely different playing field. She is going far deeper. She's trying to eradicate patriarchy from her heart, soul, mind and spirit. A very difficult task, which I think, until I read her book, I didn't even realise I needed to do. I know I want to go there. I want all of us to go there. I think I need to go there, but I don't really know how. And then she talks about needing hope with the pronouns for God. You know, him, her, them, it. And she says help. And she's wondering if others in amongst the 17 are struggling with this as well. And she says, no offence to you, Joe, but the divine is too impersonal for me. I've always loved calling God my loving heavenly father. I relish the intimacy of it. And I feel safe and comfortable there. But now every time I do, I feel as if I'm letting down the women in the room and maybe also the men and maybe even myself. Mother God conjures up all the wrong sorts of messages for me. Even a different religion, she question marks. Is this reaction also part of the influence of patriarchy in me then? And then she recalls the interview with Lacey Finn Borgo talking about mothering father. And she said maybe that's got some potential. But she was saying she's sort of quite confused and a little bit stuck then. She'd like some more input. And what do we think? And that's from Kathy. And I think the answer is not two men talking about patriarchy.
Yes. Should we mansplain the patriarchy to you?
Yeah, let's do that. That's going to help. I mean, what I think... Kathy, is look, what we have to come to terms with, I think, especially post kind of mid-faith crisis or during mid-faith crisis, is all we have when it comes to descriptors of God is metaphor. You can't take literally metaphor. You know, God is like a loving father. God is like a loving mother. God is like a rock. God is like a mother hen. God is not literally any of those things, but they are metaphors trying to describe some aspect of God. And so, you know, if you find helpful, loving Heavenly Father, that is a perfectly legitimate metaphor to use to describe the divine. For me, the divine, I don't find the divine impersonal. I find the divine rather intimate, actually. That's just my experience, but many people have said that to me as well, you know, that it's a bit impersonal. No, I feel like this loving creative force permeates me and permeates the beauty of the sunsets and the trees and the sea and the people I see all around me. It's an extraordinarily intimate thing, so that's not a problem for me. That said, sometimes I call God he, she, whatever. Spirit of the tree, spirit of life, spirit of the sea, spirit of the sky, spirit of the stars. Yeah, I'm very happy to use lots of metaphors for God, and I don't feel stuck with any one in particular now. I just think it's slightly damaging for us if we use the same one over and over again, because it's probably a sign we're getting too attached to the metaphor. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I broadly agree. I think that the problem is not so much the metaphor as the system or the imposition of metaphors on people as fact or as the only acceptable metaphors that you can use. You know, these are the authorized ones, and they're often from scripture or whatever. I really respond to the father, and that's actually, I didn't have a particularly easy relationship sometimes with my own father, so I'm not basing it on that at all. I just find that the fatherhood metaphor really wonderful. I find it helpful. I find it great. I don't think I would want to impose that on other people if they don't find it helpful.
No,
you know, if they genuinely don't like that. And I wouldn't want to restrict the use of other metaphors either. We have to accept that, you know, apart from sort of mystical direct encounters with the divine, everything we say about God is in translation. It's always in translation, and therefore translation can be a tricky thing. You can get it wrong, Or you can an image that works in one culture doesn't work in another culture at all. So I think that you do have to work hard at it. This is, I think, sort of circles right back round to the worship song I was talking about. There's no translation gone on.
Yeah.
There is just this sort of almost use of mandatory biblical metaphor. So we'll just lump them together.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Lion of Judah.
Yeah.
What has that got to do with people in Oxfordshire, really? I mean, without unpacking it. And obviously, theologically, biblically, historically, there's all kinds of things in that metaphor. But as a metaphor to sing,
as a modern
and to respond
hymn,
to quickly, it's hopeless, isn't it? Root of Jesse. Okay. What is Root of Jesse?
I'm going to ask you to let it go now.
No, you see, this is the thing. Because and here's another one. Now, here's one that wasn't in that song, but here's another one. Washed in the blood of the Lamb.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that takes us back to Revelation.
Yeah.
When I was, you know, bored during a recent service, I thought, I saw that in a hymn, and I was thinking, how many times is that used in the Bible? Once is the answer. One verse in Revelation. That's all it is.
Mm.
And yet it's become this kind of huge thing.
Yeah.
Everywhere else when the word washing is used, it's about baptism or about washing feet. Or it's about normal water.
Yeah.
Not lamb's blood, you know. So why not use water washing, soap as a metaphor, rather than, you know, the innards of a small mammal, you know.
It's a very good point. And well made. And listen, we've talked about pronouns of God. We haven't talked about patriarchy, but I will just say from my perspective, because I do feel as a man, it's not the most helpful thing for me to be talking about. But I will say that it has been extremely damaging to women in particular, and arguably to children as well. Patriarchy is the view that the male is somehow superior. And the best way to force that agenda in the world is to kind of make out God is male as well, and therefore males are somehow more in God's image than women are. And that's why you end up with religions where, you know, some of them don't even think women have souls and that they're men's property, and all that. So much damage is done. And I think that some people have done the work and said, actually, so much of the Bible is born out of patriarchy. Even the assembling of the Holy Bible was done by a group of men with an agenda that wasn't necessarily a holy Christ-like agenda. It's definitely worth investigating, and maybe we will get a guest on, I think, to challenge us and to talk more about that. That would be really helpful.
Well, I think Lacey did talk about that. I think, you know, I think you just have to keep challenging your preconceived ideas. I've come to the conclusion for myself that it's virtually impossible to eradicate it from my mindset, because I'm not saying that's a good thing, but that's just where I am. Those assumptions were part of growing up in the 60s and the 70s, and they're very, very hard to get rid of that unconscious bias.
No, they're part of our unconscious bias, and therefore and that's what makes me uncomfortable talking about it at times, because I cannot see all of it because I'm born out of it and a part of it.
And equally within the Bible, how could it not be imbued with patriarchy, given when it was written and by whom it was written? It's almost impossible. So what you have to do is you have to make every effort, I think, to talk with people, to understand where they're coming from, to look for the victim in scripture. I think that's really important, to look for the voices of the women, to look for how they're treated, and to just find the positives in there if you can. And if you can't find the positives, to really mourn the negatives that are there, and to seek not to be part of that as best you can, you know. And I think surrounding yourself with people who will challenge you is always good. I, you know, 40 years with my wife and I have 3 daughters. Believe me, the patriarchy is regularly challenged in my household, if not
sure
elsewhere.
It's and in mine. And that's a good thing. I should say I did very much try to get Sue Monk Kidd on the podcast, but no joy there, I'm afraid. But I thought that would be wonderful. Maybe I'll try again. Why not? Well, look, we have been going on for quite long enough. It'd be good to finish with things. Is there anything else you wish to say before we go?
No, thank you very much for writing in, as ever. Thanks to everybody who contributes. Thanks to everybody who listens. Thanks to people who recommend the podcast. Thank you so much to everyone who supports us financially. That's pretty wonderful. Anyway, you know, I do meet a lot of people who talk about the podcast to me, or so they've recommended it to other people, and I'm blessed, truly blessed by that. I love that. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, folks, ever so much. Have a great week, and let's finish with this. With Claire, this is going to be her theme for the year, so maybe some others will want to make it a theme. Life is short, and we do not have much time to gladden the hearts of those who travel with us. So be swift to love, make haste to be kind, and go in peace to love and serve the Lord.